Could I have your attention again, please? Thank you very much. Time to get to work. I hope everybody enjoyed their lunch. I'm Checker Finn with the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation. As all of you know, the topic of education reform looms large at the Philanthropy Roundtable, not only because of the stellar work done by Rebecca and her team to keep things active and lively, but because a very large fraction of the members of the roundtable have elementary secondary education reform as a major agenda for themselves and their foundations and their philanthropic activities. It's also the case that a great many people at the roundtable are involved one way or another with a family foundation, big or small. Family foundations and family-related foundations come in many flavors, part their idiosyncrasy is part of what makes them so lovable. We have for this session the intersection of education reform and family foundations, and we have before you three of the most significant family foundations in the education reform space in America, and three of the most interesting family members in the education reform space in America. They are biographed in your material, so I'm not going to take time to do more than just identify them. Kerry Walton Penner, who's going to speak first, obviously is involved with the Walton Foundation and with education reform all over the place. John Fisher, the son of Don Fisher, who was here with Doris just a few years ago and whom we miss enormously, is with the Fisher Family Foundation, and the more targeted but nevertheless national education reform activities that they're involved with. And Barbara Hyde is a force to be reckoned with in Memphis, Tennessee, and across the state of Tennessee in education reform with the Hyde Family Foundation. I'm going to show you just a few slides about the foundations, and then we're going to invite each of them to talk for not to exceed 8 minutes about their strategy, their family, how things are going, how they settled on the approach they've settled on, lessons they're learning. Then I'll ask them some questions, and then we'll open it up to all of you. Now, I'm going to do my best to see these slides as I put them on. We're going to go in the same order. The Walton Family Foundation pursues a three-sector strategy organized around parent choice. It's regional and national. You may not all know about some of the regional work in places like the Arkansas Delta. They've also targeted a number of individual cities as places to concentrate on school choice. This is a lot of money. This is $132 million a year in education, about half of what the foundation as a whole does. And they've co-founded some very consequential organizations in the education reform space, some of which are listed at the bottom of the slide. They spend of their education funding roughly 30% to shape public policy. Charter school advocacy groups, for example, private school choice groups, for example, parent empowerment groups, for example, ranging from great schools to Bayo. Onto the next slide, half of their education funding goes into creating quality schools themselves, about 200 a year in the charter sector. Very substantial chunk of the American charter school enterprise owes more than a little to the Walton Family Foundation, but they also support Fisher Fellows and Building Excellent School Fellows as a leadership development strategy, and they do program-related investments in facilities. They work on improving existing schools with about 20% of the education dollars backing the D.C. teachers contract, for example, getting involved with the new teacher project, for example, Teach for America, for example. Switching over, the Doris and Donald Fisher Fund, scaling what works and challenging the status quo primarily via charter schools. National strategy, 100% education, known for turning KIPP into KIPP from two little schools in Houston and New York. The modern KIPP owes quite a lot to Don Fisher's vision and the continued support of the Fisher Fund. But it isn't just that. National Alliance for Public Charter Schools, Charter School Growth Fund, other advocacy organizations, increasing the supply of high-quality charters, human capital, advocacy, and some specific geographies as well. About half of their education spending, which is all of their spending, goes to increasing the supply of high-quality charters. 12% into human capital, things like Teach for America. 11% into advocacy work, things like the National Alliance, the California Charter School Association, Ed Voice, the California Statewide Reform Advocacy Organization. And 20% into a geographic focus in targeted cities like, won't surprise you, New Orleans, Washington, D.C., Newark. We'll come back to Newark later in the discussion. The Hyde Family Foundation, hands-on entrepreneurial force multiplier to improve student achievement, predominantly in Memphis and around the state of Tennessee. Almost half of their total giving goes to education, and Barbara mentioned to me before lunch that almost half their total giving and about 99% of their energy and attention go into education reform. Memphis is a proof point, and they view it as a proof point of what works and what can work in education reform with implications for state and national work. Some of the major national reform groups have come to Memphis because of them. Listed up here, statewide advocacy work in charter schools, in academic standards, in some of the advocacy organizations that are now active, and rather newly active, I would say, in Tennessee, and probably wouldn't be active if it weren't for Hyde. Looking at their major strategies, high-performing school models, including Catholic schools and public charter schools. They've done some very interesting work in the Catholic school sector in Memphis. Human capital development, you're beginning to see a certain amount of repetition on some of these names when you see things like Teach for America and the New Teacher Project and New Leaders repeated, because all of these foundations have gone to where they find effectiveness. And are seeking to multiply that and bring it to places where it hadn't been before. And public policy advocacy with, here just suggesting three of the Tennessee organizations that have been much involved in this, in that state. Scale, Walton, $133 million, and 300 grantees. Fisher, $25 million, 30 grantees. Hyde, a little under $8 million, 37 grantees. And take a quick look at governance, because these are family foundations. Walton, 11-person board, all family, 10 education staffers. Fisher, a 2-person board, one family member, 2 education staff. And Hyde, 8-person board, 7 family, 2 education staff. That is the overview. That is the quick comparison. And without further ado, we're going to take it from left to right, Carrie, and then John, and then Barbara. You're on.
Thank you. I'd like to start by thanking the Philanthropy Roundtable, Rebecca Stewart, and Adam Meyerson for providing really the venue to be able to talk about education reform in the United States. And it's clearly right now is a great time, and there's a lot of national focus coming out of what's happening nationally with Race to the Top and over the last year and a half, 18 months. Excuse me. And then recently with the release of Waiting for Superman and the various things in media that have come out of that between 2 days on Oprah, NBC's Education Week, and it's an incredible time to be involved in this. So it's something that's very exciting. If you haven't seen Waiting for Superman, I would recommend it, and I'd recommend it to your friends. I'd like to start talking a little bit more broadly about the Walton Family Foundation. We are, as you heard, it's 48% goes into education reform. Last year we had a total of $276 million in grants. The additional amount is split pretty evenly between two other areas. We have our home region, which includes Arkansas, Northwest Arkansas, and then the Mississippi Delta region of Arkansas and Louisiana. And there we're really focused on economic development and investments as well as education reform. And then the other area, our third area and our newest area, is in environmental programs. And it's not quite split yet, but eventually it'll be split. We do quite a bit of work in sustainable fisheries. And the second area is
Unsustainable fisheries.
It's freshwater conservation in the Mississippi River Delta, Mississippi River Basin, as well as the Colorado River Basin. So that makes up the other 50% that's outside of education reform. The foundation really was started formally in 1990 when we hired our first education director. We've been ramping up since then. Our main ramp up has come from in the last 10 years. In 2000, we gave away $58 million. Of that, $40 million was for education reform. So we have, getting to $133 million last year, we've over tripled our grants. And it's difficult to grow quickly and to do it well. And so that's one of the things that we've really been focused on across all of our grant making, is making wise investments and having a solid strategy. I'd like to focus on the education and the way that we, our strategy and theory of change that we have in education reform. We started in Arkansas and really started looking nationally and how do you do this and how do you do it well. And I think we did a good job at the beginning of thinking this is it's a large system. And it's not just the way, from our approach, it's not just public education. At that time, there were no charter schools. And so we were looking at it as, for this full system and for low-income students, how do we approach this in a way that allows low-income students to have excellent educational opportunities the same way that any of us in this room have options for our children. We're able to move. We're able to afford private schools. And so looking at it that way as a kind of a large umbrella of education and what education looks like more broadly defined. And our ultimate goal is for every child to have excellent educational opportunities. The theory of change and the hypothesis that we ended up coming to was that if you have choice and if you have options in your educational institutions, it creates competition, and choice creating competition will ultimately end up in increasing the outcomes and increasing the quality across the board. And this is where we get to some lessons learned. That in and of itself, and I think competition in and of itself, it's not enough. And so one of the ways that we've learned this, I think, is, and one of the important lessons learned as well, is really listening to grantees and being out there, and you do roll up your sleeves because it's worth doing that. And hearing from grantees and those who are on the ground working, seeing what works and what doesn't work, seeing what's missing in the portfolio of things that we're investing in. And one of the things that's really surfaced in that is public policy, the importance of advocacy, focusing geographically on where are we investing right now. We started with charter schools, investing and trying to grow charter schools wherever there was a decent law. What we've done since then is really focused geographically. We have 7 districts where we are very deep. It's Albany and Newark, New Jersey, Washington, D.C., New Orleans, Denver, Los Angeles, and I think that's all. I didn't count very well. And so we've really – oh, and did I mention New Orleans? And Milwaukee. Thank you. And so we've done that, and we've really had a chance to get deep. We've been able to focus on market share with charter schools. We've been able to work with innovative school leaders in the traditional public schools. And then where possible, we've also been able to help the low-cost private operators in those areas. So that's been a great lesson learned. The public policy, and I see I have almost taken my time. The importance with it, well, where we are right now and looking forward from 2010 on, the public policy is a very big issue. And then as we look at across the entire sector, actually, quality is a huge issue in schools. And how do we address low-quality schools and operators in the charter sector, in the private sector, as well as in the public school sector? And so those are issues that we're really focused on addressing through policy and in working with in each of those areas going forward.
Terrific.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I might have said earlier that in the on the very short list of education reform philanthropy saints that America deserves over the last decade, along with Don Fisher, is John Walton, whom we miss quite a lot in this realm. And you all have carried on phenomenally and improved. It's
Thank
great.
You.
John.
Thanks. So I thought that rather than sort of pay a tribute to my father, I would still like to take you sort of through his education, because I think it applies many to many of you out there. It applies to anybody who sort of says, you know, how can I make a difference? So in 1998, my dad, for those of you who don't know, was the founder and CEO and chairman of the Gap until 1996, when he became just the chairman and founder. And he had been doing philanthropy, mostly locally based, focusing on kids with the Boys and Girls Clubs of San Francisco and Boys and Girls Clubs of America, as well as supporting many things in San Francisco and the arts. And in 1998, he came to me, and I manage our family's investments. And one of the investments I had made was in the Edison Schools, Edison Project. And my dad came to me thinking I knew a little bit about education, and in 1998, and said that he and my mom wanted to focus a lot of their philanthropy on trying to have a major impact on public education. And I said, well, what does that mean? And he said, well, I'd like to have systemic change. I'd like to do something that's sustainable so that I don't have to fund it forever. And I want it to be replicable. And I said, oh, that's easy. What do we do tomorrow? You know, he thought big. So the first thing we said was, well, you know, Edison Schools is out there. They're doing some really amazing things, but they're not in California because the per pupil spend in California isn't high enough. So if the foundation supports Edison coming into California, maybe that's a great way to make a big difference. So that's what we did. The foundation put up some capital to bring Edison into California, opened a school in San Francisco. It was highly controversial because of the whole for-profit nature, and even though Edison wasn't making any money, that was beside the point. And you know, it was a battle. The school board was split on whether to support this. The superintendent was for it. You know, we had people calling my father names. You know, finally one school was approved through all of this. And my dad looked at me and says, what have you gotten me into? And I said, hey, I'm the youngest son. This is my job. So he said, you know, that was great, but I'd like to do something that maybe is a little less controversial. And I said, well, you know, maybe we should hire somebody else to come in here and replace me. So Scott Hamilton came out from Massachusetts, where he had been running charter schools, and took over running my parents, their baby, their little educational foundation. And Scott was given the same, you know, major impact on public education, systemic change, sustainable, replicable guideline, and said, okay, you have 6 months to find the perfect thing for us. And I was like, you know, this isn't going to happen. But somehow, 6 months later, literally probably 6 months minus a day, and Scott's first call was to check her, by the way. Scott sat down with my dad and said, I've got something to show you. And he showed him the 60 Minutes segment on KIPP schools, which at that point was basically just two fifth and maybe sixth grade sections one in Houston and one in the Bronx, run by these two entrepreneurs, Dave Levin and Mike Feinberg. And my father said, "That's incredible. Can I meet those guys?" So Scott brought Dave and Mike into my father's office, and my dad said, what's holding you back? How do we replicate this? And they said, "Well, we need to find more Dave Levins and Mike Feinbergs. You know, we need to come up with a way to identify people like that, like us, and train them in what it means to have high expectations." And all the aspects of what makes a KIPP school a KIPP school. And my father said, "Well, do you think we'll be successful in doing that?" And Dave, at least this is lore, Dave Levin says to my father, "Well, Mr. Fisher, we're happy to use your money to try." True story. So that was sort of the beginning of what became the KIPP Foundation, which my parents were, the initial major funders of, and many other people have come in, including the Walton family and Barbara's family as well, to help grow this sort of incredible network of schools around the country. So today, there are, 99 schools serving over 26,000, almost all at-risk children. And it's been a tremendous success. But the thing I'd also like to discuss besides just KIPP is that my dad, over sort of that 10-year period, really dove deep into understanding education reform and getting very personally involved, serving on lots of boards, giving lots of money away. But even more than that, not more than just sort of serving on the boards, got really actively involved in what was happening in these organizations. And more than anything, I think looking for highly motivated, smart entrepreneurs who he could back. I think they sort of, reminded him in a sense of himself. And so that was sort of a major goal. And over that 10-year period, my dad did, he served on the California board. This is a guy who knew nothing about education reform when he went into this. Thought he knew everything, by the way, but he came to realize he really didn't. But he served on the California State Board of Education for 8 years. He chaired the KIPP Foundation and helped it grow from 2 to 99 schools. He supported Teach for America, but in a pretty unique way. He sat down with Wendy Kopp and he said, "I want to get more Teach for America teachers into charter schools and into charter school leadership positions." And so his funding was specifically focused on that goal. He helped fund with John Walton the Charter School Growth Fund, which has supported many 18 charter CMOs around the country. He helped fund the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. He was on the board of EdVoice along with Carrie. And he helped start the New Teacher Project, which Tim Daly was nice enough to comment about earlier, in which he backed, a young entrepreneur, Michelle Rhee, who had come out of Teach for America. So I just point out all the things that he did. I can talk later about what I'm doing, but I get dizzy sort of thinking about it all. But it really, I think, goes to show what focus and dedication, a little bit of money helps too, but a willingness to take risks, to think big or think small, to learn. My dad spent that whole 10 years, I think, really learning every day about what could be successful and to have a lot of fun. So,
thank you very much, John. EdVoice, parenthetically, is a very important California statewide reform advocacy organization that I think wouldn't have existed if John Walton and Don Fisher hadn't seen the need for it. Onward to Memphis.
Thank you. Well, I want to start by saying how I'm a little nervous and incredibly honored to be sitting on this platform with members of two of the most important, committed, and dedicated families working in philanthropy today. And I think about what they've done and how much we've learned from it, and I'm just grateful to be here. I guess I'm here in a way to represent the little guy, as much as the little guy can be represented in a ballroom at the Ritz-Carlton with a bunch of affluent people. But in the context of these kind of numbers, our foundation is I suppose, a little guy. But I think that what's exciting about what we're doing is that I hope we're beginning to demonstrate that a little guy can have some big influence. And, you know, these are such exciting times in philanthropy right now. We're at a pivot point, a turning point, tipping point, whatever you want to call it. And every one of you in this room has a role to play in that. And so I hope I can share with you just a minute or two about the Memphis story, about how a family that chose to focus its philanthropy partly out of commitment and loyalty to where we made our money, but also out of a recognition of the limits of our resources and how to have impact, how choosing to focus locally can have an impact beyond just our city. So I guess we're an example of a foundation that's chosen to take a comprehensive city-based focus in education reform. And over the last 10 to 15 years, we've kind of narrowed our focus on a set of building blocks. And we've had some great recent success with Tennessee winning Race to the Top, with Memphis being chosen as one of the Gates deep dive sites. And suddenly people are saying, wow, Memphis, overnight success. Well, as all of you know, overnight successes are you know, usually 10 to 15 years in the making. But we chose to focus on Memphis because we felt it was a city like many mid-tier cities that had all of the problems and challenges of any city, but one that we could get our arms around and get to a tipping point quickly, get to scale quickly. As we thought about how to city build, how to move a city forward, clearly all roads lead to education. I don't have to convince this group of that. So what are our building blocks? Like everyone on this panel, we've focused on trying to create high-performing schools. Our philosophy around that is that there's no one model that works, and that we've tried to bring multiple models to Memphis. We've been beneficiaries of the great work of the Fishers, and are building, in the process of building, what we hope will, it's now one school about to scale to five in the next couple of years, and we hope to get way beyond that. Our superintendent is viewing it as a real partner for him in putting schools in neighborhoods that have a real need. We also have invested in the Jubilee schools, Catholic schools, and, you know, our focus is just what works, and can you find the leaders and the right people on the ground to invest in, who are committed to academic achievement for all kids and have what it takes to make that happen. Along the way, of course, we learned, and we had a real lesson with KIPP. When we first opened our first KIPP school, we were very excited. Great model. We didn't get the leadership right on the front end. And that taught us a huge, huge lesson about the value of leadership, that even when you have, and the Fishers know this well, it's why they've invested in leadership. But we've expanded that to an emphasis on how do we get the right talent in place in all levels, in the classroom, at the principalship. And one of our investments I want to highlight around talent, human capital, is new leaders for new schools. When you look at schools around the country that are working, in spite of the obstacles, it's usually about a great leader. So how do you get more great leaders who can lead the effort in charter schools, who can lead the effort in traditional schools? And I think New Leaders for New Schools is one model that's having an impact in training principal leaderships. So we've gotten very involved. I'm on the board of that, again, trying to learn as much as I can and get engaged around how do you bring talent to the table. Our final building block has been around effective public policy. Carrie mentioned that. I think everybody in this room realizes that's where you have real leverage, that if you can use your philanthropy to help drive change in public policy, the impact will be systemic and sustainable and replicable the things that Don wanted. And it's a way that we in Memphis, I think, have been able to, we like to talk about being able to, I guess it's a boxing analogy, kind of hit above our weight class. And so we've gotten involved in being advocates for charter schools, both as individuals and in the appropriate ways through the foundation. We got involved just years of family relationships that I know all of you have in your communities, helping get school board members elected, working with the mayor, working with your local delegation in the state legislature. I can't tell you how many times we as individuals, you know, made the trip to Nashville to work on charter school legislation. We have to not be afraid to do that, and we have to all, of course, do it the right way, but this is a huge impact. The most recent example around public policy is that we got involved in trying to raise the state standards in Tennessee.
They had nowhere to go but up.
That's exactly right. I mean, we started looking at the fact that we were telling the kids in our state that we had an 80% proficiency rate. Well, when you took our state standards and translated those to national standards, it was more like 22%. And if you looked at children of color, it was more like 6 or 7%. So we felt we were telling a lie to the families in our state, and we had to get involved in helping our state learn to tell the truth. So we worked with our governor, got him engaged in that, helped connect him with Achieve, a great organization many of you are involved with. And as a result, our standards are in the process of aligning to national standards. This was a big piece, I think, of us being able to win Race to the Top funding. One example of the advocacy piece. So I'm going to reel off quickly what we think some of our lessons learned have been. As all of you know, effective philanthropy is about more than simply writing the checks. It's about rolling up your sleeves. It's about doing whatever it takes to get the job done day in, day out. Finding the right building blocks to build on, staying the course. We can all afford to take a long view. We're not elected, right? We don't have to get reelected. We can stay the course and do what's right over the long haul. Learn how to punch above your weight, as I said. Learn how to leverage your influence and your assets by getting engaged in the public policy arena. Don't be afraid to take risks. The obligation and responsibility of giving is huge, and you don't want to make mistakes that hurt anybody, but you've got to take some risks and be transparent about it and be willing to learn from each other about it. And don't go it alone. This is a great network to be a part of. We learned so much from Checker and from the people sitting up here on this panel. We've got to learn from each other to use our assets wisely. I guess the last point that I want to make before closing is that we're very excited that Memphis, having come from the bottom, is now poised, I think, to be a model. And if we can keep pushing ahead and create a proof point for how you really turn a city around using education as the lever, then it can be done elsewhere. And I want to invite those of you who want to extend your influence beyond your own community to join us in Memphis. I'm shameless about it. But it's true. If it can be done in a community like Memphis, it can be done anywhere. 40 years ago, Martin Luther King, on a storm-filled night, the night before his assassination, spoke to a huge crowd assembled to support the sanitation workers' strike. And this makes the point, the connection to education being the civil rights movement of our generation. He said, "I'm delighted to see each of you here tonight in spite of a storm warning. You reveal that you are determined to go on anyhow. Something is happening in Memphis. Something is happening in our world." Well, this is an exciting time in education reform. Something big is happening, and you all can be a part of it.
Fantastic. Thank you, Barbara. Let's talk quality control for a little while. Not all schools are good. Not even all KIPP schools are good. At the beginning, we had a bump start in Columbus, Ohio, too, a couple of years ago, though that's going better now. How do you know not all grantees are good? Some of them don't do what they said they were going to do, or it doesn't work. How do you know is the first question. What are your barometers, your indicators, your feedback system? And then what do you do? Do you just cut them off? Do you intervene? Do you try to fix it? What's the approach to a problem grantee that isn't accomplishing what you expected of them? Anybody, but I'd like to hear from everybody before we're done.
I'll just pick a specific example of, you know, as you said, not 100% of our KIPP schools are great, though the most thankfully have been.
Your batting average is pretty good.
Batting average is pretty good. And we've had to deal with situations where, you know, where an individual school isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing. And the first thing that we do is we pour resources, generally people, into finding out what's wrong, to try and see if there's something that we can do to improve the performance of the school, and if we determine that it's a leadership issue, that we'll work to change the leadership at the school. And in those cases where, for example, local boards will not support a leadership change, we'll take our name off the school.
How many times has that happened, to your knowledge?
A couple times, Chris.
Four or five. And you got 99 schools now?
Yeah.
Okay, so 4 or 5%, you actually came to the point where it wasn't going to get fixed, so you actually said you no longer get to fly that flag.
Right. Now, you know, it's not like we want to see the schools abandoned, right? We hate the idea of leaving because the kids stay there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we work hard to make sure that at least there's some semblance of, you know, of an ongoing school. If another charter organization can come in and manage that, you know, we're very supportive of that. But at the end of the day, it's important, at least in the case of KIPP, that our brand means something, that the quality means something, and so sometimes we have to make the hard decisions to take the name off if it's not meeting our expectations.
It's a painful choice when it comes down to choosing between quality and your brand on the one hand, and kids being left in the lurch on the other hand.
Yeah.
So, Carrie, you've got all these grantees all over the place.
Apparently 300.
I'll take your word for it. What do you do when you get word that one of them is just not delivering the goods?
So it really depends on the type of grantee. We work, as you saw, across a huge number of different organizations.
Yeah.
Our startup funding for grantees for schools, we will, if they are not in their first few years while they're under the startup funding, or even in the planning phase, it's a few different tiers. Every year they're reporting back. And so we approach it from a really almost a venture philanthropy approach where we're going in and we're partnering. And we try to provide the support to see if they can turn it around. Sometimes it takes new leadership, sometimes additional funding and some hand-holding and sometimes opening other doors as well so that they can become connected and really be able to do what they had promised they would do. There are organizations at the state level, state associations, that we've helped to reconfigure, and sometimes it's because it's not going well, and sometimes it's because there are more effective ways to bring different organizations together and be more effective. I think this is where it comes to being very close and partnering with your grantees and really finding out what works, what they need help in, and then sometimes cutting them off.
Sometimes cutting them off.
That certainly
has
happened.
I assume that's not an easy decision where you've been working with a grantee for a while.
No, and again, it depends on what area they're working in.
Yeah.
And how it is. Is it impacting specific children? Is it impacting teachers, schools? And so that makes a difference in terms of how that process looks.
If memory serves, you've also invested in some data gathering systems and some external evaluation type arrangements, so
yes.
You get more feedback, not just from the grantee themselves.
Correct. No, we have used third-party evaluators on several projects to get more academic feedback as well. And we've partnered with the government on that as well. And so it's great to have those data points to really know what's happening.
We'll talk in a minute about partnering with the government, the ups and downs of that. But Barbara, quality control.
Well, I'm tempted to do what politicians often do, is to use your question to make a related
that's,
point.
That's what's called media training.
But, well, to the point of being accountable and transparent and recognizing when things don't work and making changes, I think philanthropists have that obligation. We also, in the schools that we fund, have that obligation to model for districts what districts don't do, and that is close down schools that aren't performing. Push them to change. John made this point. I'm really taking a page out of something you said this morning at breakfast, that in the charter school movement, we probably need to do a better job of being quick to identify schools that are the lowest performing schools, intervene when we can, but then shut them down, because that's what systems need to learn to do. And if we can't model that ourselves, then we're not teaching the systems what they need to learn.
Okay. Sectors.
Can I say one,
yeah, go ahead,
one,
John.
One more thing,
sure,
on that. You know, we have backed, you know, as you can see, a relatively small number of organizations. And, you know, I think we all go into this really focusing on who's running the organization, and, you know, and deciding that this is somebody that we have a lot of confidence in. But the other thing to look closely at is the board. And, you know, is the board made up of people who are going to be, you know, critically evaluating the performance of the organization, that are going to be looking at the goals that have been put out there, and that are willing to do the same kinds of things that you're willing to do? Because if that's not the case, then, you know, then it's a tough organization to go in and back. The counter to that, I think, is it also depends on how big you are, right? If you're a small investor in a big organization, the board doesn't necessarily think the way you do. You're at the whims of somebody else's decision. If you're the dominant investor in the organization, then, you know, you can have a lot more impact, even if the board isn't necessarily completely supportive of everything you want to do.
I want to talk about sectors within the education world for a minute, because if I'm understanding things correctly, Carrie, the Walton Foundation invests in district situations, in many charter situations, and in private school choice programs, all three sectors. Barbara, if I understand things correctly, Hyde is involved in all three sectors in Memphis. These sectors don't always like each other. They don't always get along with each other. They frequently feel competitive with each other. From the two of you, I'd like to know whether it isn't awkward and dysfunctional to be trying to play all three, put bets on all three horses in this race. And from John, I'd like to know why you're not going into more sectors than you're in, which I believe is just one of the three.
Well, you know, I guess, Checker, I don't think it has been all that awkward investing in all three, and maybe it's because of our local focus. Mm-hmm. But we think it's critically important that competition is valuable, but that we can also play a role of creating a little healthy competition, but also being a convener and someone who brings these people together to learn from each other, so that human beings can just build relationships, and we all know that is a first step toward making progress. So I think in our case, investing in all three has been 99% positive.
Okay. Carrie, is that your take too?
I think investing in all three, we don't see it. There are three pieces of a stool, and you have each leg, which is critical, and it's a critical part of the whole. So we don't delineate it as three completely separate areas. And it has provided on occasion some uncomfortable conversations. A couple of examples of that are both in Washington, D.C., actually, working with getting the charter school sector to 38% of the student market in Washington, D.C., and We funded a lot of those schools as they were opening, and we're very focused on getting a higher market share in Washington, D.C. One of the consequences that ended up happening with that in the low-cost Catholic schools was a number of them ended up shutting down several years ago. Those were also schools that we were funding and involved in. And it was a difficult, there was a tension there. But it's a competitive environment, and that's ultimately what we'd like to see. And then with the contract and Michelle.
Which the charters weren't so happy about, because it led to some of their teachers being swiped.
Recently, supporting Michelle Rhee and the teacher contract coming through in the traditional public school sector and increases in teacher compensation, there were, and I don't know what the numbers ended up being, but the significant concern among charter school leaders that they're losing teachers now to the traditional public school, and that's part of competition. So if what we really believe and we stay true to our theory of change, that competition ultimately is good and raises the bar for everyone, it's there are tensions there.
Yes.
But we feel it's worthwhile.
Living in Washington, I also watched the interesting phenomenon of the charter sector, for the most part, backing the alternative to Michelle Rhee and Adrian Fenty. Vince Gray, who won the mayoralty, won it in part, maybe small part, because the charter sector said, we like him better. John, are you content to stick with the charter strategy?
I've been a choice and voucher supporter.
Yeah.
But we have chosen at our foundation to really focus on charters. I think for us that has allowed us to, play a bigger role in that specific area, as opposed to, I think, to some extent diluting what we do by focusing on in-district reforms or vouchers. I continue to support choice personally, and I think we will see lots of changes. As the government continues to change every 2 years, we find more and more opportunities around the country that didn't exist before. As a foundation, our focus, like Carrie's and like Barbara's, is really to provide the best educational opportunities for kids around the country, mostly at-risk kids. We have found that at least charters have been perhaps an easier political fight to take on. Although that's changing, as my charter friends, as my voucher friends, tell me again and again. But we have found that sort of charters have been, again, with the President of the United States and the Secretary of Education, both strongly supportive of charters. That seemed like that was less of a fight than some of the other issues that we might take on.
So let's talk about government for a minute. Does your strategy assume that your foundation is working in partnership with government and public dollars? Or do you see yourself doing things that government can't or won't or shouldn't do? Or do you see yourself pointing the way to where government ought to be going? Or all of the above or none of the above? How do you view your relationship with government?
I would have to say all of the above, I guess,
okay,
depending on the situation. But the government in 2008 spent $582 billion on education at the state, federal, and local level. And the top 50 education reform donors spent $1 billion. So it's less than 0.2% of what's going into education. And so I think because of that, it has to be an approach to how can you partner and when can you partner, and then how can you do things that they can't do? And I think that I think with Race to the Top and the I-3 funding that is coming out of the federal government, they're starting to use some of that, those small number or small percent of funding to create innovation in the states. And it's created a huge amount of change at the state legislature. And 20 states passed teacher effectiveness laws, and 10 states either got rid of or raised caps on charter schools.
through the Race to the Top process. And to be able to create that kind of change, it's great that through, I think, philanthropic funding, we have been able to show that innovation comes with those carrots. And they've, I think, done that very well recently.
John, let's characterize your relationship with government or the foundation's relationship with government.
You know, charter schools are publicly funded. So so obviously there's a partnership, so to speak, that has to come through the fact that, that charter school, the funding comes in through the state, mostly the state. But I guess I would say that, in the organizations that we've been a part of, I don't feel that we have changed our direction or our focus to meet a government objective. I feel actually that the government is essentially another investor, just as we are, in something that we think is a positive reform. And and if the government wants to put money into to education, they should back what works. And so if they want to back the reforms that we're involved in, that's terrific.
How much did Kip just get from the I3 fund?
About 50 million. 50
million
over
50 million.
Over 5 years.
Yeah. Barbara, government.
Well, I think we too believe you have to approach it all three ways. You have to lead and get out ahead of government when you have the opportunity to do that, and back them up when that's the right thing. And we've tried to do all three efforts at all levels of government too.
Okay. Switch from government to families. Some family foundations have just proven to be nightmares. Either people just bicker and don't agree, or some have even essentially come apart and assigned each family member a certain amount of the money. When the door is closed and the staff is gone, and you all have very small staffs, by the way, given the size of what you're doing, when the door is closed and the staff is gone, how does the family reach agreement and stay in agreement, if it does, about strategy and direction and priority?
Well, in our case, we following my dad's death, we sort of split up responsibilities. So I have two older brothers. One became very involved in the arts.
Okay.
I've been already involved in education reform, but I took over much of what my father was doing in this area. And at least, thankfully, my brothers have been sort of like, thank goodness someone is taking this on and we don't have to have anything to do with it. So far, that's worked out pretty well. And where things don't work, I can blame it on Chris, who runs our Fisher Fund. But my mother is the ultimate decision maker here. I mean, this was hers and my dad's foundation, so... we're quite deferential to ultimately what she wants to do.
But she hasn't had to break many ties, it sounds like.
No. Knock on wood.
So, Barbara, when your door is closed, it's a relatively smaller population inside the room, isn't it?
Yes, and we're still at the phase, although my husband's grandfather provided initial funding for the foundation. My husband really built up the assets of the foundation. So in a lot of ways, we're a first-generation family, even though we're technically in the third generation. So we're still driving it. And so far, he and I get along great, and it's working fine. In fact, it's part of the great joys of our relationship, and one of the things we just derive the most satisfaction out of. We're now really beginning to think more deeply about how do we now transmit our values to our next generation and how do we begin to include them. And I was excited to hear Carrie talk about how their kids and she, when she was growing up, attended meetings all the time. So we're just grappling with it.
Gonna figure it out.
Yeah.
Okay, Carrie, you've got a somewhat larger population when the door is closed.
So we, I'm not sure that the staff leaves before it maybe gets messy on occasion.
Jim's very good at keeping his mouth shut, however.
We spend a lot of time, we invest a lot of our time together working on skill building, listening skills, communication skills. And I really think it's been, we've worked with a consultant for 17 years now.
Whoa.
Who has been in our meetings, and he comes and he works with family business. He's a family business advisor, but he's been working with us across a number of issues for 17 years, and it's been a huge help. We spend a lot of time thinking about it, talking about it strategically, deciding not just what are we going to do philanthropically, but how do we come together, how much percent of time do we allocate to fun, and how much time do we allocate to meetings, how much time are we out on mountain bikes, doing site visits, all of those things. So it's that's been a huge help in us being able to bring 11 people, and we actually include spouses in our meetings. So that actually takes it to, I think we end up with 18 family members in the room, I think.
And the age range now is approximately what to what?
The age range is 21 to 65.
Okay.
On our board. And my children, I have two children who come to the meetings who are 10 and 13 when they wish. And so.
They're better on the mountain bike part.
They like the mountain biking part, but they also, they go and we visit, they go on site visits. They've been to KIPP schools in New Orleans, high schools that we've been partnering with Paul Vallis in the traditional public schools there. And so really it's an opportunity to spend time together and ultimately, when we sit at the dinner table afterwards and when we come together, it's what we talk about. And it's really the glue that binds.
I'm going to apologize to the audience because I hugged all the time, but I've got one more question I got to ask, and then I think we're going to be out of time. So apologies to those that have been waiting with their questions. But these folks are going to be here to come up and buttonhole and ask. I want to turn to Newark for a second and ask you, when you read that Mark Zuckerberg was giving $100 million... to the Newark schools, what was your first reaction?
You first.
Honestly,
first,
now.
So first reaction is that he's fortunate he has a place like Newark where I think the ground has been laid for it to be fertile to really make a difference. And that's been, as Barbara mentioned about Memphis, it's been a long time in coming. We've been working in Newark with a coalition of foundations, large education reform foundations, for 5 years, I think. And with Cory Booker as well, and since he became mayor. And so it's... it's a great opportunity for him to be able to do that. The $100 million is a lot, and I'm not sure that they need all of that money. I don't know how strategically it was thought out in terms of how it's invested and the highest impact that it will have. So, and I think that they're still working on that. So.
Okay.
Cory came and talked to me about it, and, what can I say? I love the guy. He's a great leader. He's strongly supportive of education reform and choice. And so my second reaction was, what is Newark spending $20,000+ per kid need more money going into the system? But I will say my first reaction was great. We have a guy, who up to that point has, as far as I know, not been involved in any, ed reform, efforts. And, he identified somebody who I think most of us agree is a great leader and decided to back him in that effort. And so I thought that was terrific.
Barbara?
I suppose my first reaction was, $100 million, that's a good start for a guy with Zuckerberg's wealth. a nice initial investment. My second reaction was, now how do I get him thinking about Memphis?
brief anecdote, and then we'll close. I'm sure some of you saw some of the Education Nation stuff on NBC the other week. I was sitting there in New York. They put a big tent over the skating rink in Rockefeller Center. And 600 people, education reform types from all over the place, are sitting in this tent. The rain is coming down harder than I think it's ever come down in New York. The tent is beginning to leak and drip on people. The noise on the tent is so loud that you can't hear what's being said on stage. What's going on stage is Tom Brokaw and Mark Zuckerberg and Cory Booker and Chris Christie, the mayor of New Jersey, are all up there talking about this money. And nobody can quite hear what they're saying to each other, but we do hear the following. When Mr. Imperturbable, Tom Brokaw, says in a rather alarmed tone of voice, "Would all of you please head to the side of the tent as quickly as you can? There's concern about the structure." There was so much rain on the roof of the tent. And I'm still reflecting whether it would have been a good thing or a bad thing for American education had that tent collapsed then and there. Please join me in thanking a terrific panel.
Good job.
Yeah, you too. Good job.
Class dismissed.